This is the second part of the fifth class, and I'm moving through 1974, where Ireland has been present. The new government, the new Labour government, then obviously the Labour people were very happy they got back into government after only 4 years of a Conservative government. So, you know, the Labour Party were feeling good about themselves, even though it was a minority government. And a lot of the aim of the government was to have better relations with trade unionists, 11 million trade unionists, Many of them voted Labour. These are important people for the Labour government. And at the same time, they wanted to keep wage rises down, if possible, to a certain level. And their argument was that this was possible if you made sure people got some, felt they were getting something in exchange. Better public services, etc. And so this is one example, the passage of the Health and Safety at Work Act. 1974. The Health and Safety at Work Act was passed, establishing the Health and Safety Executive, a national organisation, and much more thorough government supervision of accidents and dangers in the workplace. The Act stated, I quote, "It shall be the duty of every employer to ensure, so far as is reasonably practicable, the health, safety and welfare at work of all his employees." The National Industrial Relations Court was abolished at the same time, which was to the satisfaction of trade unionists who had felt it was biased against them. So this is one of the things which continued to advance during the 1970s. If we look at the number of accidents at work over the last 30 years, it's gone down a lot. These are important things, obviously. Now, part of the reduction in accidents has been due to the shift from industrial employment to service employment, but not all. You know, it's also that the health and safety regulations are more solid. And certainly, if you just think of details, what I remember in the 60s, the men who came round to take away the rubbish, these were in metal bins this size, which they picked up and put on their backs. And of course, as you know today, we have plastic bins across Europe with wheels on them. Now, bins on wheels is not new technology. The reason they didn't have wheels in the 1960s is because nobody cared about it. So it really was actually, it was a social and political question and not a question of technology. And this is the sort of laws which help people think about these. And it's true that, if you go to some poorer countries in Eastern Europe, you still see people doing things in a way that really you wouldn't want them to do. Just to briefly go across the world to the United States, it didn't seem to have a huge political effect on Britain, but Nixon, faced with almost certain impeachment after the Watergate revelations, resigned. It didn't have a huge effect politically on Britain, but obviously everybody talked about nothing else for weeks. And in September 1974, two things happened. First of all, Harold Wilson confirmed that a second general election for the year will be held on the 10th of October. So you see the situation. He has his minority government, but obviously he would prefer to have a majority because it's very tiring and very unstable and very dangerous. And so he chooses, because this is the situation at the time, the Prime Minister can choose the date of the election, he chooses the 10th of October for a second general election in the same year, something which doesn't happen, obviously, very often. Technology was also moving forward with the opening in September 1974 of CFAX, which was one of the first public service information systems. Do you see how this works? It looks... It's the same idea, but much slower. Okay, and so you had to punch the number, and then it would very, very slowly, it would go through all of them until it came to it. But it was tremendously impressive at the time, because your television was telling you things because you'd asked it, which was something which was very, very unusual. This is the life before Google. the CFAX. The Labour manifesto was for the October election was published under the title Britain Will Win with Labour. It claimed that the Labour Party was the party of social justice, whereas the Conservatives represented, according to this manifesto, the party of conflict. According to Labour, effort and sacrifices were necessary due to the international economic crisis, but such a programme would only be accepted if people in Britain felt that all were being fairly treated. I quote, "Why should a coal miner dig extra coal for a few pounds more while he has seen property speculators grow wealthy looking at empty office blocks?" The manifesto rejects the idea of a coalition government as a cruel farce, since different parties have different philosophies. It defends Harold Wilson's record, expressing pride at a list of achievements made over the last 6 months. In particular, the abolition of the Industrial Relations Act, more taxation on the rich and less on working people, more security of tenure for tenants. That is to say, if you rent your flat, you can't be expelled so easily. And the beginnings of a renegotiation of membership terms for the common markets. It also says that more money had been made available for teachers' pay and for student grants. The manifesto insists that a broadening of public ownership is key to helping Britons prosper. Labour intended to extend public ownership with the aim of, quote, protecting jobs and, quote, encouraging investment. Far from an unfortunate last resort, as Conservatives would tend to think of it, nationalisation was seen by this manifesto as a way of increasing popular control over the economy. Plans were revealed to create new rights for employees and their representatives. Joint control on many issues was planned for industry, and there would also be a new wealth tax on wealth over £100,000. In public services, the most notable reform was the idea of phasing out private beds in National Health Service hospitals. The existence of such private beds was denounced as queue jumping. Yeah, you're jumping the queue for hospitals. Prescription charges were also to be phased out. On housing, it was said that council purchase of development land would be encouraged and that the disastrous fall in house building would be reversed. In education, it was announced that the party had a long-term aim of eliminating fee-paying in schools. Yeah, so they are mentioning that they would like to find a way of replacing private education. In other areas, the manifesto underlined that the Labour government had appointed the first ever minister responsible for the arts and the first ever minister of sports. Now, minister responsible for the arts, this has a certain importance because the availability of arts, museums, theatre and so on to ordinary people was rising in the 1970s. It was an important change, and it has continued to rise. This is particularly important from the point of view of museums. Rather strangely, when you open more museums, more people go to museums. You actually create demand in that way. It's been shown. On devolution, the promise was made to set up autonomous assemblies in Scotland and Wales. The British troops in Northern Ireland would stay there for the time being, although in the long term it was hoped they would be withdrawn. The Labour Party said they were proud to be able to propose a referendum on remaining in the common market, a consultation which they presented as a triumph for democracy. Finally, on nuclear weapons, the manifesto explained that the present nuclear weapons would stay, but there would be no replacement of them by a new generation of long-range nuclear weapons. Now, the proposal of a referendum is extremely surprising. There had never been a national referendum in Britain. The Northern Ireland referendum was just in Northern Ireland. In fact, many political commentators denounced referendums as not the British way to do things. And yet this referendum, apparently the original idea was from Tony Benn, and it was the solution for the Labour Party leadership because the Labour Party was hopelessly divided. And this was the only way, well, I don't know, maybe there's another way, but this was the way they found to stop the party from actually perhaps dividing. They said, okay, well, listen, we'll all agree to ask the British public, and then we will all respect the decision, because, you know, it gave them a lot more legitimacy. Now, of course, once they decided on the referendum in order to keep party unity, then it was quite normal to announce it in another way. We want a referendum because we love democracy. And of course, this is, you know, it's a good way of doing things. The opposing manifesto, published by the Conservative Party under the title Putting Britain First, criticised trade unions for taking on an inappropriate role. I quote, "We shall not be dominated by the trade unions. They are not the government of the country." The situation of the country is presented in the Conservative Manifesto as a grave one indeed. The dangers now facing Britain are greater than any we have seen since the last war. Implicitly, the Labour Party is presented as wanting to destroy the existing system. Another quote from the Conservative Manifesto: "We do not believe that the great majority of people want revolutionary change in society. Or for that matter, that the future happiness of our society depends on completely altering it." Now, what's interesting about that is there's something very, very unusual about a Conservative Manifesto even using the word revolutionary. They're obviously very frightened of something, to even use the word, you know. And they continue, "There is no majority for a massive extension of nationalisation." The manifesto, the Conservative manifesto, suggested that the country's main problem was that we must stop paying ourselves more than we produce, and promised that a Conservative government would rigorously control public spending. The priorities of the manifesto reflect the values of the Conservative Party. They plan to, I quote, "develop forms of savings which are protected against inflation," which is something which would help mostly middle-class people who have seen the value of their savings fall quite sharply because of inflation. Old-age pensioners were also to be, it was said, a priority of Conservative Party. One chapter of the manifesto dealt with the party's attitudes to trade unions. The Industrial Relations Act would not be reintroduced by a new Conservative government, it was stated, quote, "in view of the hostility which it aroused." So I have to make a concession. "A voluntary pay policy will be tried, but if that does not work, then a statutory, that is obligatory, limit on wage rises will be put in place." Turning to public services, on the question of housing, the main priority of the Conservatives was to increase the percentage of people owning their own home. To encourage this, they intended to cap mortgage rates, interest rates, and to provide grants for first-time buyers who were saving for a deposit on the house. So you see, this is a very, very interesting idea. So it meant that, you know, if you want to buy a house for the first time, basically the government will give you a certain amount of money. Obviously not enough to buy a house, but, you know, maybe 1% of the price or something, you know, but like just giving money. So this is a particular idea, a very strong idea in the Conservative Party, that they felt that the more people own their own houses, the more conservative they become. This is difficult to prove. Some studies suggest that it's true, and other studies suggest that it's not really true. But that is to say that it's a problem of correlation and causation. If you look at Britain in 1970, people who live in rented accommodation vote Labour more. But that doesn't necessarily mean that if they buy a house, they will then vote Conservative. You know, it's difficult to organise. On health, the party opposed the abolition of all charges in the health service. On education, the manifesto insisted that the Conservative Party was not opposed to comprehensive schooling in general, but that they defended the right of local councils to refuse comprehensive schooling if they wished, based on the preferences of parents in the area. In October 1974, the Guildford pub bombings carried out by the IRA at two pubs killed five people, four soldiers and a civilian. In an atmosphere of pressure on the police force to find the culprits, four young Irishmen were arrested and forced to confess. They would spend more than 15 years in prison before being proved to be innocent. what is very interesting about this is in fact, the court case, when you look at it today, appears to be a farce. These were four young men who liked drinking and stealing a bit from people and spending it on alcohol. They are exactly the sort of person that the IRA would never recruit. Because whether people think the IRA is a good or a very bad thing, they are serious professional. They don't recruit pretty criminals who drink too much. You can't if you're a secret organisation. But the forced confessions and the anti-Irish racism sent them to prison. And I, at least two of them, the first two, have written their autobiography, which is a bit harrowing, but very, 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 very interesting. In 2005, Prime Minister Tony Blair apologised officially to the Guildford Four. And they also received compensation, but you know, what can you? How can you compensate 50 years in jail? But certainly, it becomes a list of errors in, because there are more to come in a moment. Yeah, that there seemed to be a situation where it wasn't going the way things were going to go. The election then happened on the 10th of October 1974, and Harold Wilson won and got a majority of three members of parliament, so it's much better for him than a minority governed, but nevertheless very, very close. It means every member of parliament must be present every time there's a vote, etc. Ex-Conservative Enoch Powell was elected to parliament in a Northern Irish constituency for the Ulster Unionist Party. So he left the Conservative Party and was elected in Northern Ireland for the Ulster Unionist Party. The Liberal Party did very well. The Scottish National Party got an even better vote than in February, gaining 30% of the vote in Scotland, even if the number of their MPs fell to 11. And Plaid Cymru got three members of parliament. And another tremendously important event from October 1974, the very first McDonald's restaurant in the country opened in London. Again, symbolic of the rise of chains, and so on and so forth. So you have the October election. This is the Daily Telegraph, a very conservative newspaper. You need to know the five or six main newspapers and who they are. So among the, this is what we call a serious newspaper, that means there's a lot of text. Yeah. Those you have on the conservative, the most conservative is the Daily Telegraph, really very conservative. Conservative establishment, the Times, and left-wing, a little left-wing, the Guardian. Remember, the Independent had not yet been opened. It was invented 15 years later. Yeah. So those are the three big ones in the what we used to call the quality papers, which may not be the best word, but certainly they are characterised by a separation between opinion and reporting. On the tabloids, most famous one, The Sun, conservative; The Daily Mirror, very left-wing. And those are the most important ones. In the mid-market, the Daily Mail and the Daily Express, both conservative. So most newspapers were and are conservative in general. But it's important to say. So certainly, if you were given an article from the Daily Telegraph for a commentary, you would be expected to know that it was the most conservative of the quality papers. Yeah, because that would be considered to be general knowledge. In what was perhaps the biggest miscarriage of justice in 20th century Britain, there were more bombs. 21 people were killed in Birmingham pub bombings. And the six Irishmen from Birmingham, six Irishmen, the Birmingham Six, were charged. They were found guilty based on forced confessions and would spend 16 years in prison before courts recognised that they were innocents. The other thing which is very significant here is that the IRA officially declared that these six people were not members of the IRA, whereas normally they were very proud to declare that the people captured were members of the IRA, because they have a particular ideology that works that way. In any case, the other result of the Birmingham bombings was the passage of a new law, the Prevention of Terrorism Act, in November, and the Home Secretary said in Parliament that Its powers are draconian. In combination, they are unprecedented in peacetime. In December 1974, the last episode, the final episode of Monty Python's Flying Circus was shown on BBC Two, which became very popular in France 20 years later, but not immediately. The Monty Python comedy team had begun in comedy shows at the universities of Oxford and Cambridge and proposed sophisticated, absurd sketches which were probably ahead of their time, although several of their forgotten sketches contained that homophobia which was very common in 1960s and 70s Britain. They produced an innovative comedy sketch show entitled Monty Python's Flying Circus from 1969 to 1974 and followed this up with a series of films. And in December we got another Nobel Prize in Physics for Martin Ryle. Which just takes us on to first published in 1974. I'm jumping over here a little bit. The first of all, on the extreme right, the first publication of The Good Beer Guide, by the Campaign for Real Ale. That is to say, a campaign that wanted beer made in small breweries by artisans and not the big commercial breweries. It was bizarre enough, one of the most successful campaigns in 20th century Britain, because today it is extremely easy to get local, small artisanal beer in any part of England, whereas it used to be very rare. And so CAMRA, the Campaign for Real Ale, was not the most important political change, but nevertheless it says something about people's taste, because it had been said, you know, people thought that, you know, with the more and more chains of supermarkets, that everybody's taste would be the same and we'd have a uniformisation. But this is not the whole story, in fact, that you get also a repersonalisation going on. Otherwise, first published in 1974, the poetry collection of Lyndon Kwesi Johnson, the Jamaican-British dub poet who had been a member of the Black Panthers in the 1960s and in the 1970s gained recognition for his writing and performance of mostly political poetry which dealt with issues such as racism and police violence. I'm pretty sure it's him who wrote the poem "The Revolution Will Not Be Televised," just to give you an idea of it. So what's interesting about this is, first of all, there was a market in the 1970s, the late 1960s and the 1970s, for performance poetry. People would pay to come and watch him recite his poems, which was something new. And this still exists to some extent in Britain. Moving in then to 1975, we have a new Archbishop of Canterbury. Remember the Archbishop of Canterbury, the top guy in the Church of England. Of course, the proper top guy is the Queen, but the Archbishop of Canterbury, and Donald Coggan, who is usually happier than that. He became known as a firm supporter of the ordination of women. So, which is something which impresses, of course, this impresses people from Catholic cultures more than other cultures, because, you know, we're not... we have little hope of there being women priests in the Catholic Church. Although, in response to changes in Protestant churches, the Catholic Church has been almost obliged to increase the role of women in the church and during the Mass. There are a number of things which women couldn't do, which now they can do. In any case, the Anglican Church would only ordain women priests in 1994. February 1975 gives us an important change in that we have a new leader in the Conservative Party, and the Conservative Party elects its first female leader, Mrs. Thatcher. Everybody was very surprised, because a few months earlier it had been considered that Keith Joseph would be the representative of the hard neoliberal wing of the Conservative Party. However, he made a speech where he said, don't have the exact words, but he said that the problem is that the wrong kind of women are having children. It was something like that. Most children are being born to the wrong kind of women. So it had some sort of eugenicist tone to it, and this was a scandal. This was made a big scandal, and it, at that time, it meant that it just happened at just the wrong time, so he could no longer really present himself for Conservative Party leader. Margaret Thatcher decided to present herself as Conservative Party leader because she thought that somebody from her group of sympathisers, Keith Joseph being the leader, she wasn't the leader at this point, should present themselves, and she won. Now, with hindsight, so it's very important to remember, which I've said 100 times, there was nothing inevitable about this. This just, it happened that way, but it could have happened some other way, because if history was inevitable, then life would be simpler. We could work out what's going to happen in next year's presidential elections, and we'd make a lot of money. With hindsight, the defeat of Edward Heath in this leadership election is often seen as the end of One Nation Toryism, an expression used to describe the conservatism of the great post-war boom, when Tory governments were happy to cooperate with trade union leaders, work with a broad nationalised sector of the economy, very low unemployment and relatively high rates of income tax for corporations and for better off people. This One Nation Toryism had been relatively stable until the arrival of the deep economic crisis of the 1970s, when companies found it much harder to make high profits in the crisis. The pressure to reduce taxes and therefore reduce public services was much stronger, and Thatcherism was encouraged by this development. Interestingly enough, I showed her on, I put a video on my blog where you see her saying, "Oh, I don't think there will be a woman prime minister in my lifetime," which she says. Now, the next big event, yes, is in May. I think it's in May. In June. In June, there will be the referendum about Europe, but the campaign goes on for a few months beforehand. The Labour Party membership at a special one-day conference voted against continued membership of the European Economic Community by almost 2-1 against. That is to say, 60-something percent of the delegates in the Labour Party conference representing Labour Party members voted against. Only 7 of the 46 trade unions present were in favour of EEC membership. And Tony Benn proposed that the Labour Party should campaign for a no vote. But it had been decided previously to the conference that the Labour Party would only campaign if the majority was higher than 2-1 in favour of a particular option. And it was not quite. And so it was decided that the Labour Party would remain neutral as an organisation. That is to say that any individual was allowed to campaign for one or the other. So Harold Wilson, in a rare breach of traditional collective responsibility, decided to allow cabinet ministers to campaign for whichever side they wished. This is also the time, I have to mention this a lot of time, the first episode of a wonderful BBC sitcom, situation comedy, called The Good Life. And you can find this on YouTube. It's really very, very good. And it's about a middle-class couple who decide to leave their jobs and become ecologically sound, self-sufficient, growing their own food, keeping the animals and making their own clothes while still living in the rather bourgeois suburb which they lived in before. Of course, that makes it funnier, of course, and you can imagine the rest. Probably the best one, actually. In June, the government distributed pamphlets to every household in Britain, written by the official Yes and No campaigns, together with its own government pamphlet, which argued in support of the common market. In total, the Yes campaign spent 10 times more money than the No campaign. In any case, 65% of registered voters came to vote, and 67% of them supported Britain staying inside the European Economic Community. Notice that in sharp contrast to the referendum campaign in 2016, the No campaign in 1975 was dominated by left-wingers. Scottish and Welsh nationalists and Ulster Unionists also supported the No campaign. Well, it was in 2016, the Scottish National Party supported the Yes campaign, the Remain campaign. Yes. The Yes campaign was supported by Harold Wilson, Dennis Healy, James Callaghan, and the majority of the Conservative Party, including Margaret Thatcher. One could sometimes see Conservative and Labour opponents to the EEC sharing platforms. This did not always happen, however. For example, Tony Benn always refused to share a platform with Enoch Powell because of his racist views. And there is the campaign slogan logo for Keep Britain in Europe. And you can see that the Britain is going to fly if it goes into Europe. And the opposites, the No campaign, out of Europe and into the world. Yes, of course, this is a response to the accusation that they're only interested in Little Britain. So those are the two campaign things. And that's the official government pamphlet, Britain's New Deal in Europe. So what happened is that the Labour Party had renegotiated the terms. It's generally considered that the terms didn't change very much, that was just kind of a bit of a political excuse, because the Labour Party could not say, we agree with the Conservative governments on the terms, because the Labour Party was too divided. So they had this renegotiation, and the rest of the countries in Europe agreed to pretend to that things were changing, but it was fundamentally the same terms. This is a political cartoon where the cartoonist who is in favour of staying in the European Economic Community is mocking the opposition. And he's mocking the opposition because he says there's such a strange mix that at the front you have Enoch Powell, this is a racist guy, Tony Benn, the far left of the Labour Party, the most left-wing part of the Labour Party, and behind the Scottish Nationalists, the fascists, the Trotskyists, they're mocking the opposition and saying that, you know, there's such a mixed group, which was true but not dishonourable in itself. I don't have a date there, but we have the event here is the opening in September 1975, the opening in September 1975 of the National Railway Museum, which became the first national museum outside London. So this is a policy of regional development, again something which is rising in the 1970s and which will continue. You have by the 1980s you'll have the Tate in Liverpool. Now I have to think of more examples, but I'm not sure I can. Oh yeah, the National Television and Film Museum opens in the 1980s in Bradford, wonderful museum. And so this is, you know, a beginning of something which also happens in France, but a bit later, to move museums out of London. An influential report on ethnic minorities and housing showed that although there had been something of a decrease in overt discrimination by estate agents, citizens from ethnic minorities still occupied housing, which was on average very much inferior to that occupied by white people. There were fewer accusations of direct discrimination than in previous years, but this was considered to be largely because many black people did not even try to rent from white landlords anymore. They had a community response where they would say, you know, go to a black landlord, because if you go to a white one, they'll only refuse you. And of course, the difficulty is it's very difficult to prove that they refuse you because you're black. Yeah, that's the whole problem of discrimination. So certainly in housing, that was still a tremendous problem. October 1975, Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody is released. And the punk rock band the Sex Pistols gave their first ever concert. Punk was to be an aesthetic rebellion against upbeat national unity in the crisis. Where the narrator of the rock and roll song had often been a confident young man about town, and the narrator of progressive rock had been a deep poetic dreamer, the typical narrator of a punk song was a sarcastic loser. Such refrains as, we're so pretty vacant and we don't care, or There's No Future in England's Dreaming, became massively popular among young people in a society of stress and unemployment where the optimism of the post-war boom no longer seemed appropriate. Punk widened considerably the range of themes which popular music dealt with, and also with its do-it-yourself aesthetic, encouraged the setup of thousands of punk rock bands, hundreds of local magazines, fanzines, and a series of small independent record labels which together would have a huge influence on British popular music. In December 1975, the Equal Pay Act 1970 came into effect. Yeah, there's a 5 years to get it into effect. And the Equal Pay Act operates by inserting an equality clause into a woman's contract of employment. If the contract does not include one, it shall be deemed to include one. Interestingly enough, back in 1970 or 71, the Daily Mirror, so the left-wing tabloid newspaper, had a special competition. It was a fascinating idea, a special competition that said, we want women to write to us about their experience in the workplace, and the best article will win a prize, and the prize is 3 years of the difference between your wage and a man's wage for your job. Because at this time, it was 1970, it was still, it was not yet illegal. And the winner was a welder, in soudeuse, who had been a welder for 28 years and earned 75% of the men's wage for the same job. I thought I was quite impressed with that. You know, for it's a popular newspaper, it was a good idea, a good competition to get it up into people's consciousness. The whole story of equal pay will be a very long one, because the first stage in the 1970s is to make it illegal for men and women to be paid different wages for the same job. Later on in the 80s and 90s, especially the 90s, or even 2000s, there will be the idea that it's illegal to pay men and women different for comparable jobs. It's much more difficult to change. For example, only a few years ago, there was a big case where they discovered that a local council there was certain kinds of cleaning jobs which had always been done by men, and other kinds of cleaning jobs which had always been done by women, and they had different wage rates. And this was a very famous case. There were thousands and thousands of women involved. I can't remember the exact details of that. 1975, at the end of 1975, I think we're still in 1975, the very first woman newsreader on the BBC, Angela Rippon. So obviously that has an important effect. Undated events in 1975, the first meetings of the Gay Labour Group were held, lobbying inside the Labour Party for gay liberation to be taken more seriously. For the first time, a woman was qualified as a rabbi in Britain, a Jewish rabbi. And the Campaign for Homosexual Equality declared it had 6,000 members around the country. So it's not big, but you know, it's obviously something that actually really exists. Yeah. It has to be said that the idea of a campaign for homosexual equality is very interesting, because you have to remember that the legalization of male homosexuality in 1967 was not, by today's standards, was not motivated by such a progressive idea. These poor homosexuals, their life is terrible, they have this terrible illness, so you know, we shouldn't put them in prison as well. It was that kind of level. You know, it wasn't suddenly that everybody was understanding stuff that they've understood since. Oh, not yet. In 1976, there were 12 million trade union members in Britain. Which brings us. I'm going to go into 1976. And in 1976, then, January 12 provisional IRA bombs explode in London's West End. This is a continuing, I'm not telling you every time there are bombs, but you know, it's just a continuing regular situation. And the House of Commons rejected by 181 votes against 120 a proposal to end corporal punishment in state schools. And corporal punishment, yeah, hitting children, will finally be banned by law in 1987. But it's interesting that it isn't just that they forgot to ban it; they actually had a vote and lost it, or it went the other way. In February, the Cod War flares up again, and Iceland breaks off diplomatic relations with Britain. And in March, Merlin Rees, the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, changes his policy about prisoners in Northern Ireland. You know, these are the Republican and Loyalist prisoners in Northern Ireland. And what they do is he decides to end special category status. This means that before March 1976, these Republican Loyalist prisoners had basically been considered as kind of prisoners of war. And so they had been kept in a prison which resembled a prisoner of war camp. I put up a video about the Mays prison, which tells about this. And in fact, they had 100 Republican prisoners in this put, then 100 Loyalist prisoners in that one, then 100 Republican ones there, and they were like separate. And they communicated by throwing tennis balls. They put the message inside the tennis ball and threw the tennis ball. But this was only possible if the enemy, the Loyalists, would accept to pass on the message. And they did, because they had a sort of military prisoner of war mentality, you know, that, you know, what's, you know, very pragmatic, yeah? So in fact, they actually cooperated inside the prison, even though they, outside the prison, were trying to kill each other. But strangely enough, this cooperation in the prison actually helped 20 years later, the peace process, because the people who knew each other in prison as enemies found themselves in the political negotiations. Yes, some very interesting things went on there. In any case, in March 1976, he says, okay, you're not prisoners of war, you're criminals, just like everybody else. You have to wear prison uniforms. The Republican prisoners, who considered themselves political prisoners, refused to wear prison uniforms, and they were therefore confined to their cells naked, and they could only wear a prison blanket from the bed. Since they would not wear uniforms, prison officers refused to allow them out for exercise, and so they were in their cells for 24 hours a day. And this went on for years. And it was there was no real compromise possible, because from one side they were criminals, and from the other side they were prisoners of war. And you can't, there wasn't really a compromise possible. In April, Harold Wilson surprised the nation by declaring he was resigning. The Prime Minister was resigning. Not because of a political crisis, not because he'd lost his majority, just because, in fact, he had decided a couple of years earlier that he was going to resign. Although it was later found that he had been suffering from the beginnings of Alzheimer's disease, which was not very well understood in the 1970s, so he probably didn't call it that. He probably noticed that he was slower. Although he had been very, very fast, with an incredible memory and stuff, so, but he noticed that. Now, the announcement took everybody by surprise, although some of his closest allies had been told some time before. A number of rumours about unsavoury scandals about to break circulated, but they were all untrue, and it soon became clear that the resignation had been planned for a number of years. An election was quickly held to replace Wilson as leader of the parliamentary party, and therefore as Prime Minister. As is tradition, he drew up a resignation honours list, which recommended people for knighthoods, OBE medals and MBE awards, all of which carry much prestige in the British establishment. The presence of some of the names on the list caused considerable controversy, as the names appeared to be there as personal favours to personal friends. Wilson was much attacked in the media for this list, nicknamed the Lavender List. Yeah, that he, there was people who were, it was kind of, you know, people who had helped his secretary with a loan. I mean, it was pretty pretty iffy. So it wasn't corruption, but it was something which was considered to be pretty tacky. In April 1976, the first ever female British ambassador takes up her post to Denmark, and the United Kingdom wins the Eurovision Song Contest with the song Save Your Kisses for Me, sung by the Brotherhood of Man. Do you remember the song? Have you heard the song? It's dreadful. James Callaghan defeats right-winger Roy Jenkins and left-winger Michael Foote in the Labour Party leadership contest, thus becoming Prime Minister. So who was James Callaghan? James Callaghan, son of a naval officer, was from an ordinary family, and he had left school when he was 14. So he was this far away from the different other leading Labour politicians like Michael Foote, who went to Oxford and was president of the Oxford Union Society. Very left-wing gentleman, but you know who was, James Callaghan left school at 14, which was the time for working-class people to leave school. He became in 1945 a Member of Parliament for a Cardiff constituency in Wales. He was Home Secretary in the late 1960s, and it was he who took the decision to send British troops to Northern Ireland to try to deal with the crisis there. After the Labour victory of 1974, Callaghan was responsible for renegotiating the terms of British membership of the European Economic Community. And when Wilson resigned in 1976, Callaghan was the oldest of the candidates to replace him. Indeed, at 64, he was older than Wilson himself, and some commentators held this against him. Now, James Callaghan in the Labour leadership election was no doubt not the most popular of the candidates, but he was the least divisive. And this is often enough. This will happen again when Margaret Thatcher resigns. And John Major is not the most, the best loved, but he is the least hated of the candidates. This can be useful. He was elected by the Parliamentary Labour Party. At this time, unlike in later decades, only Labour members of Parliament took part in the election of the Labour leader. Neither trade unionists nor Labour Party activists had a say. And that is very different today, of course, because we're in a situation where all members of the Labour Party vote, and so Jeremy Corbyn is in this rather unusual position of being very, very popular in the Labour Party and very, very unpopular among Labour members of Parliament, which is exciting and interesting. And in June 1976, we finally get to the end of the Cod War. And the UK and Iceland end this. It's not really a war. It's always Cod War. It's always put into inverted commas. There is some shooting, but nobody gets killed. Yeah. A few ships are sunk. Now, strangely enough, the Iceland actually kind of wins. It might be considered surprising that Iceland, a much weaker country, economically speaking, achieved its most important aims by the end of the conflict and was allowed to have exclusive rights to fishing for a 200-mile limit off its shores. The result was a very severe blow indeed to the British fishing industry, and many fishermen lost their jobs. The explanation of Iceland's victory is its strategic geographical position from a military point of view. Indeed, by implying that it was willing to leave NATO if the fishing dispute was not terminated on advantageous terms for Iceland, the country was able to impose its terms. In the same month, July 1976, the Seychelles, a British colony since 1814, gained its independence. You've got all these little places gaining their independence throughout the 70s. In August 1976, the government and the Trade Union Congress agree to a stage two agreement on pay rises. That is to say, for one more year, even more limits on pay rises. and the trade union leaders agree. Now, this is a difficult negotiation because remember that trade union leaders, like most other people, are not all powerful. So when they are discussing with the government, what they're discussing is, well, what can you give us? Because we don't want a Conservative government, we're trade union leaders. So we want the Labour government to be successful. But the problem is, we have to persuade our members, and if we don't have something to give them, we can say we support it, but they won't follow us. See, so it's very difficult. It's a real negotiation where the important people are not just the ministers and the trade union leaders, it's the ministers and the trade union leaders and the impression that these two people have of how far the ordinary trade unionists will follow. Remember, 12 million trade unionists, yeah? That's a lot of people. And so there is a moment when the trade union leaders kind of say, well, we can't accept that because they won't follow us. And so it's all very careful. And you know, there sometimes concessions are made in other areas. You saw the Health and Safety at Work Act. Now, this was not directly a suggestion of the trade union leaders, but it was something that the trade union leaders could use to say, well, yes, we know, talk to the base, we know you don't like having low wage rises with the inflation being what it is, but you can see this is helping the Labour government, who are doing so many things for us. It's real negotiations going on. Also in August 1976, during the Notting Hill Carnival, 100 police officers and 60 carnival goers were injured. So severe fighting. It sounds like the police were not very well prepared, when you have more police injured than carnival goers. The Notting Hill Carnival are very, very important symbolically because it is a Caribbean carnival, enormous Caribbean carnival on the streets of London. And so symbolically, it's saying, we are at home here, we want to make a lot of noise and dress up very colourful in the streets. We don't just want to be accepted, tolerated, we want to really be at home. The police are unhappy about this, and also accidentally, if you like, a cultural problem in that among West Indian youth, quite often the recreational drug of choice was not alcohol, but cannabis, which is illegal, of course. And so let's say that if the police wanted to attack the carnival, they had a very, very good excuse because they were fine. So that made things worse. This has changed a lot. In the 1960s, you still heard Conservative newspapers sometimes saying the Notting Hill Carnival should be banned. Whereas you never hear that today. In fact, today you will find that before the Notting Hill Carnival, for months, people who are organising the carnival or making the costumes or something will be going around the schools. The schools will invite them to look at carnival arts and the history of the carnival and the history of the West Indies. And so it's become institutionalised multiculturalism. Whereas in the 1970s, it was outside the establishments, and that's been a big change. Which is, I always think we use the word integration too easily and too vague, but obviously it is an element of integration. In September, I have no more pictures, but I have a few more facts. In September, in Derry, in Northern Ireland, the Northern Ireland Peace People. Organised a demonstration against violence. The Northern Ireland Peace People was established in 1976 on a programme of denouncing violence and had for a short time considerable popularity. At least one of its marches attracted tens of thousands of people, and Joan Baez came to sing at the rally afterwards. Big star. The political position of the Peace People, finally, much harder on IRA violence than on Army or RUC violence, stopped it from playing a deeper role in the later peace process, as it was often seen as naive about the British state. The Peace People campaigned in the United States, for example, against fundraising for the IRA, but would not denounce violence by the British Army in the same way. The two co-founders of the Peace People received a Nobel Peace Prize, but the agreements in 1998 and after, which led to a suspension of the military conflict in Northern Ireland, came from political choices by groups that had been involved in the military conflict, did not come from groups who denounced violence. In fact, the leaders of the peace process were the leaders of the military groups, which is interesting. Although it's not the end of the story, I always say that the military conflict in Northern Ireland has been suspended. I would not like to say that it's over. Although it does seem, I mean, as you probably guessed, I'm not a great supporter of British policy on Northern Ireland, but it does seem that the 1970s was, even from the point of view of the British government, spectacularly badly managed. The internment, Bloody Sunday, it was almost like they wanted the IRA to raise. I think they were just not very good at it, you know. But it was. I think even, I don't think there are many people who would say, oh, British governments in the 1970s, they were really good at managing the situation in Northern Ireland. I think it's generally considered, you know, whatever people's political position is, as a bit of a disaster. A disaster. I just have one or two months more. Yes. James Callaghan, there he is again. He made a very important speech, which sometimes has been presented as the real turning point and the real end of the post-war boom and the associated post-war political settlement. Now, that's a matter of opinion. But as you know, many people consider the arrival of Margaret Thatcher as the turning point. Some commentators put it with the speech of James Callaghan. James Callaghan made a much commented on speech which appeared to firmly reject the Keynesian policies which had been so influential in previous decades. Now, you don't have to know in great detail the theories of Keynes, but the general idea is that the government, by creating employment in public services and by guiding the economy, can make the situation better. Yeah. Whereas the opposite, the neoliberal idea, is that the less the government does in the economy, the better. You have to do some things, but it's an unfortunate necessity. Those are the two big ones. You don't need to be experts in Keynes, which I am not. So what did he say, James Callaghan? He said, I think it's at the Labour Party conference, he said, we used to think you could just spend your way out of a recession and increase employment by cutting taxes and boosting government spendings. That option no longer exists. This speech was the prologue to an intensification of budget limitations and even cuts in public services. Critics at the time noted that the shortage of money did not seem to affect such expensive policies as the choice of a nuclear defence. So, what was he saying here? Yes, well, notice that that option no longer exists, and this resembles, in some ways, the famous statement, which I don't know if Margaret Thatcher ever really said, but she's supposed to have said, "There is no alternative." Now, again, said de Bonnegere, if governments want to do something, it's not surprising for them to tell people that there's no alternative. You know, we even do this in our personal lives, don't we? You know, if we want to persuade somebody, there's no other way to do it. It's kind of human. But really, I think that the lesson from a historian's point of view is there's always an alternative. There's always an alternative. There's no such thing as inevitable policy. And certainly, from a British point of view, the enormous social spending in 1945 to 1955, when the country had no money at all, or appeared to have no money at all after the war, shows that really the centre of it is it's centrally political questions. Other things were moving forward at the time. Fast trains, for the first time in October 1976. The intercity 125 trains with a top speed of 125 miles per hour were introduced by British Rail. Now, it has to be said that these are a lot slower than French trains, but then again, we are lucky in Britain because Britain is not very big. Yeah, I remember the first time I came to the south of France in 1983, we came in a minibus, and I thought, I had no idea that France was so big. Yeah, because if you drive from Calais to, what was it, Toulon, it really takes a long, it's awful, an awful long time. Okay, well, that is that. I actually got even a little further than I thought. I got to October 1976, and so I think I should have no problem doing the. That, so I did 3 years, and I have 3 years to do next week. I missed a couple of things out, but I think that will do for today. Thank you for listening for so long, and I hope to see you at this time next week.